Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
My name's Adrian Goldberg. Thanks for downloading the 5 Live Investigates podcast. This week, the parents spending £2,000 to store the blood from their newborn baby's umbilical cord in the hope that it will cure any serious disease they contract in later life. But we'll hear from experts who say it's a form of insurance that may never pay out.
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Investigates with Adrian Goldberg.
Hello, my name's Adrian Goldberg and welcome to 5 Live Investigates. Tonight, you're a new parent and you're offered a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity which could one day help save your kid's life. And it'll only cost a couple of grand. All you have to do is send off some blood from the umbilical cord of your newborn baby to a company who'll place it in cold storage. And if the little one gets a serious illness in later life, hey presto, that blood could be a lifesaver, thanks to the emerging science of stem cell technology. Who could resist such an offer? Thousands of mums and dads have already signed up, but we'll hear from experts tonight who'll tell us the whole process is a waste of money. And as always, we want your comments and stories. Are you storing your baby's cord blood? Is it worth the money? Or are these companies making promises they'll never be able to keep? You can drop us a text on 85058. You can tweet at BBC5Live on Twitter or email goldberg@bbc.co.uk. And our reporter Phil Kemp is with me. And Phil, why do people think that blood cells from their children's umbilical cord might be useful?
Well, it's because umbilical cord blood is a rich source of stem cells, which are valuable because of their potential role in combating disease. Stem cells are already used to help treat diseases like leukemia, but some believe that their potential goes much further. Stem cells can be used to create human tissue, and in theory, they could be used to repair and replace damaged organs, as well as treating diseases ranging from Alzheimer's to cancer.
So the idea is that if you can store your child's blood, then cells from that blood sample might later save their life. But is there any evidence to support that theory?
Well, this is where medical opinion is divided and the answer isn't clear-cut. What we can say is that the Royal College of Midwives and the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists say there's just not enough evidence right now to justify the routine collection of cord blood for private banking. Now, there's a range of estimates, but some experts put the chances of parents needing to use stem cells they've banked privately for their own child as low as 1 in 20,000.
So it sounds as though parents are taking a costly punt on medical technology developing at some point in the future, which might then enable the stem cells collected from their newborn babies to become useful. That didn't deter San and Palmjit Sangera, originally from the West Midlands, now living in Dubai, who decided to invest around £2,000 in having the umbilical blood stored from their son Rowan when he was born.
We looked at it as an insurance policy, just in case something happened in 10, 15 years and my son needed something, let's try and retrieve this and then use it at some point later.
And what were you told that the cord blood would do?
There were vague promises, but nothing concrete that they'd said. They just said, you know, in the future it might help with this or it might help with that. There's lots of research going on. So there wasn't a specific promise made to say, you know, this will help you in this instance. It was more around, it may be useful in the future if something untoward happens.
And we'll hear more about San's story later, but were they taking a financial risk that just couldn't be justified by the science? Well, let's talk to Dr. Anne Hunter, consultant haematologist at the University Hospitals of Leicester NHS Trust, where they don't allow private collections of umbilical cord blood. She's a director of transplantation for the Trust. Dr. Anne Hunter, good evening to you. What is your objection to this practice? Don't parents have a right to decide what to do with their money?
Good evening.
Hiya.
Thank you very much for the question. Well, I think that there are several issues here, but the first one is that the Human Tissue Authority, who licensed the procurement of cells for any form of transplantation, have made it clear that hospitals have a responsibility to ensure that practices that happen on their premises are legal and fulfill certain standards. And when third-party companies are coming in to collect within a hospital, it's impossible for the hospital to know whether the consenting, the procurement, the storage, the testing, etc., are to a standard which fulfill the legal requirements. And we, as a trust, decided that that the obligations that the Human Tissue Authority wanted us to take were over and above those that we felt comfortable taking, and we decided to avoid putting our organisation and staff at risk.
So that's the reason that you, as a hospital trust, don't allow the collection of umbilical blood, cord blood from newborn children. But what is the difference between storing cord blood stem cells in a public bank, as you do at your hospital, and storing them privately, as the Sanghera family did?
Right, so that was the discussion we had, and we decided as a trust that we would go into partnership with the Anthony Nolan, who's a very well-known charity for the procurement of cells on behalf of patients for unrelated donors, and have been for many years. And doing that gave our families an opportunity of putting cells into the World Bank for treatment which is already well established for the management of patients who need a transplant for diseases like leukemia, and to offer the greatest good for the greatest number of people.
So essentially, if a person does develop an illness for which stem cell technology can be useful, and we know that in some cases it can be useful, you're suggesting that it doesn't need to be stored privately. There is a bank of stored blood out there from which stem cells can be used for anybody who might need it.
Exactly.
Now, there are concerns as well that some cells are stored in private banks, which therefore aren't available to members of the public as a result.
Well, I think that's true, but the Anthony Nolan are trying to make us, as a country, self-sufficient for our cord blood. They're trying to collect about 50,000 cord blood units that will be stored within the United Kingdom, which we hope will make us self-sufficient and will result in us being able to offer treatment to those patients, those families who need it.
Is there ever an occasion when having your own stem cell blood might be useful to aiding your recovery from a serious illness?
So as the science stands today, the answer is no. And to my knowledge, no cells that have been stored under private circumstances have been used.
Now, we've talked about your situation at your hospital, you know, the fact that you don't allow parents to have blood privately collected for storage in private blood banks. Have any of the parents complained about that or been upset about it?
In fact, until we opened our Anthony Nolan partnership, there were one or two people who requested it, and we informed them that we would be happy to refer them to a unit that was collecting so that they could deliver their baby and have the cord cells collected. But since we've had our Anthony Nolan partnership open, we haven't had a single family request.
Aren't the companies, though, who store these blood cells right to point out that at some point in the future, given the enormous developments in medical technology, that these stem cells may potentially, at some point in the future, be useful?
I think the science is going to have to be broader than that, because if we're talking about diseases these children may not have for 70 or 80 years and a need, a worldwide need for stem cell therapy, doctors are going to have to develop treatments that don't just benefit the few, but benefit everybody. And I think, therefore, it's very unlikely that personalised stem cells are going to be required, that the science will need to be more gregarious than that, and will have to enable everybody to benefit.
Okay, so let's just clarify then, though. If you are reading about stem cell technology and the help that it might give to serious diseases, you're saying that there is no need to have this privately stored because there are enough blood samples stored in banks which are available to everybody, which might be used if you have a condition that stem cell technology is useful for.
That is my view.
And is it your view, then, that parents who are spending up to £2,000 to have these umbilical blood cord samples stored are wasting their money?
Well, I think parents are very vulnerable. I don't know if you're a parent. I'm certainly a parent.
Yeah,
and I know
am.
Every
I
parent
am.
Wants to do the best by their children.
Yeah.
And so I completely understand the emotional pull of this situation. But as I said earlier, as we stand at the moment, there is no evidence of benefit, and much better to put cells into the international cord bank, because not every cord unit that is collected is successful and is clinically satisfactory to be used. But even those that aren't can often be used for research in order to push forward the sort of advances that these companies are suggesting to parents might in the future occur.
Dr. Anne Hunter, thank you. Might return to you a little bit later. Phil Kemp alongside me. Clearly, Dr. Hunter, Phil, isn't the only one with these kind of concerns.
No. In fact, I showed a couple of these companies' websites to Ken Campbell, who's the Clinical Information Officer at Leukemia and Lymphoma Research. The first website I showed him was for a company called UK Cord Blood Bank.
When you look carefully at that list of conditions, many of them on there are ones where you wouldn't use HR's own stem cells, even if they were stored. If a layperson was reading it, you know, a mum-to-be, you would get the impression that there are dozens upon dozens of diseases where it's a clear-cut issue. These can be treated with a transplant using the child's cells collected from its cord blood. And that quite simply isn't true.
Well, let's have a look at another website that we've got up here. This is the Future Health website.
I've got a page in front of me listing, oh gosh, probably about at least 40, 50 conditions. Of those, the only ones which are standard therapies, there are two listed which actually recommend use of what are known as autologous stem cells, which is the child's own stem cells. All of the others recommend use of donor stem cells, but that's not apparent from this page. These are all things which are present in the child at birth, so using its own stem cells would not cure these.
Now, Ken also told me that these companies had both listed other types of cancer as conditions that would benefit from stem cell transplant.
And do they?
Well, they do, but with stem cells from adults, not blood from a child's umbilical cord.
So, essentially, for the conditions that you might get, they don't appear to be much use at all. What have Future Health had to say about this?
Well, they told us that they're committed to providing accurate and balanced information about their services, and they say that all their material is checked and regularly reviewed by an independent panel of scientific and medical experts. They say that the list on their website covered all known uses of stem cells transplants and was sourced from a foundation set up by a respected US scientist. They say because they're a family cord blood bank, they've not distinguished between different types of stem cell transplant on their list, that is between use by the child themselves or by a sibling or close relative, but they have disabled the link to the list for the time being until they can make any amendments.
I've got the UK cord blood bank statement here. They've told us they've always been proud of their complete disclosure regarding the abilities and limitation of cord blood stem cells. They say they caution families about these facts so they can make informed decisions, and like Future Health, they say it's an established fact that siblings and other family members may and have been matches for a child's cord blood stem cells. We'll take your comments on this. Would you spend $2,000 storing the blood from the umbilical cord of your newborn baby? You can text us on 85058, email goldberg at bbc.co.uk, or on Twitter, we're at BBC5Live.
5Live Investigates
with Adrian Goldberg.
On 5Live Investigates tonight, the latest fashion for new mums and dads. Thousands of parents have paid thousands of pounds to have stem cells from their children's umbilical cord blood stored. But as we've been hearing, some experts say this is an insurance policy that will never pay out. If you want to drop us a comment on this, you can text us on 85058, email goldberg at bbc.co.uk, or you can tweet us at bbc5live. Phil Kemp is alongside me. And Phil, you've been looking into how different hospitals handle requests from parents to have a sample taken from their child's umbilical cord, because there are concerns that some hospitals are promoting the practice because they have a direct financial interest in it.
Yeah, it's a very mixed picture. On the one hand, you've got hospitals like the University Hospitals of Leicester, where Dr. Hunter is based, that won't allow private collection at all. But then you've got hospitals that actually get paid by these companies for each collection made.
OK, Phil, tell us about what we know about those that do allow the collections to be made.
Well, the Royal Free Hospital in London told me that they had agreements with four different companies and they get paid £50 a time. They said they borrowed their policy from another hospital which did the same thing, but they wouldn't tell me which. East Cheshire NHS Trust has just one third-party agreement, and that's with a company called Cells for Life, and they said that they get £100 a time for collections. Other hospitals I spoke to did allow private collections, but they didn't expect any money for it.
And we know about one other company that has gone even further. Future Health has an agreement with Arrow Park Hospital on the Wirral, where each week midwives offer parents-to-be a guided tour of their facilities. And at the end of the tour, a member of the Future Health team is available to answer questions. They say there are also leaflets and posters explaining the service throughout the unit. Earlier, I spoke to the Future Health's midwifery advisor and UK business development manager, Tracy Thomas. Are Arrow Park staff involved in the collection of cord blood for your company?
Absolutely not, not in any way whatsoever. They have been involved in staff awareness sessions, which is just merely giving them information about how the process takes place from start to finish. So they do have literature around the hospital, but that contains a specific number, which is a 24-hour contact, where the clients make direct contact with ourselves at Future Health, so the staff are not involved at all in the process.
The arrangement that you've got, this partnership, might suggest that you've got the hospital's endorsement for the collection of blood from a baby's umbilical cord. People might not realise that there are many experts in this field who are hugely sceptical about the product you offer.
Well, that could be perceived in that way, but the idea of us having the arrangement is so that families in the UK and certainly in the area local to Arrow Park Hospital are just aware that the particular service exists and they can make a truly informed decision to go ahead should that be their choice. And it's certainly not an endorsement from the hospital, but just to support the family should they so wish to go ahead.
Has any of the cord blood that you have collected ever been used to save a life?
Not at this present time that I'm aware of.
There you go. Tracy Thomas of Future Health. And Phil, what about the hospitals that don't allow the collection of umbilical cord blood? Why are people concerned about that?
Well, it might help here to clarify what the law actually says about this. Basically, you need a licence from the regulator, the Human Tissue Authority, to collect cord blood. Mm-hmm. If you're a hospital that isn't licensed, you can still do this, but you need a third-party agreement with a private blood bank that does have a licence. And these companies would usually then send in someone from outside, known as a phlebotomist, to collect the blood.
So what's the problem with that?
Well, last year, the regulator wrote to 150 organisations to warn of concerns about unlawful cord blood collection, which they said compromised safety and quality standards. In one case, they said the cord blood had even been collected in a car park, and that's presumably because the hospital hadn't allowed the collection on its premises. The sample was contaminated and had to be disposed of. But the HDA said that they'd had at least two other reports of parents being given the option of taking the placenta and cord from the hospital to collect the blood elsewhere. And clearly there's a big risk with that the sample's going to be useless. In fact, the HTA told us that they'd taken regulatory action against 21 hospitals where they were told that unlawful collections had taken place.
Well, thanks, Phil. And that story takes us right back to San and Parmjit Sangera, who, as I say, originally from the West Midlands, now living in Dubai, who stored their son Rowan's cord blood with a Brighton-based company called Cells for Life. Somewhere between the maternity ward and the storage company, the sample was contaminated. The company gave the couple the option to carry on storing it, which they did. But at 10 months old, Rowan was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. So was his blood sample, taken at birth, able to help his condition? Sadly not. When his parents finally tracked down researchers carrying out trials into cerebral palsy, the contamination meant the sample was unusable. This is Rowan's dad, San.
When my son was around 10 months old, he was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. You know, obviously that was a massive shock to us, etc. We started trying to work out what the treatment options would be, what kind of therapies were available. The options in terms of actually using it at that point were very, very limited. We found one place in the US, Duke University, who were doing some clinical trials. So we got in touch with Duke University and said, well, is there another clinical trial happening? Is there any chance of us being able to get onto it? And we sent them a scanned copy of the results from the stem cell company. And they wrote back and unfortunately said that because of the contamination that was there, the risks to Rowan from having this treatment would be too great. Potentially life-threatening is what they said. That was a real kick in the teeth, to be honest. You know, you think you've done everything correct. You've taken out all the insurances that you think you need. You've ticked all the boxes. And then despite all that, some non-sterility of some sample has ended up meaning that it's not going to be able to be used. That was a huge kick in the teeth.
So you've spent substantial sums of money investing in what you regarded as an insurance policy, but it gave you, in the case of your son Rowan with cerebral palsy, no insurance whatsoever.
Absolutely. In the end, it's been useless so far. We've spent a lot of money and had a lot of heartache, and we can't go down the route that we thought we'd be able to use this for.
Well, we're joined now by Rebecca Roberts, who's the operations manager for the company Cells for Life. Good evening to you, Rebecca.
Good evening.
Interested, why did you carry on storing a contaminated sample for the Sanghera family? I mean, wasn't it clear at that point that it wouldn't be usable?
Well, contamination does not mean that samples are useless, and there are examples where contaminated cord blood has been used without adverse effect. These are across the world studies that have been done. It is a decision solely for the parents as to whether they want to continue storing a contaminated sample in the unfortunate event that contamination is found.
Yeah, but they have to take your advice, don't they? And they're not really in a position to make an informed decision about whether it's worth it or not. In their case, the contamination meant that the storage was for them completely useless.
Well, we do provide comprehensive information to the parents to allow them and put them in contact with other resources if they require, so that they can come to an informed decision. And as the client said, it was for the point of view of using it for cerebral palsy, which was not something that they anticipated the sample to be used for in the clinical trial that they were looking at. Not useful, but that doesn't mean to say that it might not be useful for something else in the future.
Doesn't it? Isn't the fact that this sample was contaminated and was not suitable for clinical trials for cerebral palsy, does that not tell you that this blood sample can never be used, or do you maintain that it can?
Well, as I pointed out, there are examples documented in peer-reviewed publications where contaminated cord blood has been used without adverse effect. And one study actually concluded that clinical sequelae following infusion of microbially contaminated progenitor cells is extremely rare, and prophylactic empiric antibiotics may be unnecessary. So, yes, I think that on that basis, given contaminated cord blood samples have been used successfully, there's a chance it could be.
Well, even if it hadn't been contaminated, what use would it have been? All the family was able to do was track down a clinical trial in the United States, and that's not a cure for cerebral palsy, is it?
No, it's not. It's a clinical trial which is looking to provide a treatment for cerebral palsy. It's like a number of other clinical trials going on in this very new and very fast-moving area of medicine, looking at providing alternative treatment options to people using stem cells.
So what is the evidence that the blood samples you collect will ever help cure an illness?
It depends on which particular disease you're looking at. Clearly, things like leukemia and other blood cancers, there is a very strong history since 1988, in fact, about using cord blood to treat those. But if you look at the number of papers that are published on a weekly or monthly basis in international peer-reviewed papers, and you look at the number of different diseases and disorders that they are looking at, and you look at the number of clinical trials which are being approved globally for using stem cells, and specifically cord blood stem cells, for different diseases, the range is vast.
Well, Rebecca, let me ask you this simple question. Simple answer, I'm sure, from you. How many samples that people have stored with you have been used in the UK to cure serious illnesses?
Fortunately for our parents, at this particular moment in time, none, but we do expect that to change in the coming weeks.
Let's speak to Rosemary Exton, who is a director with the Royal College of Midwives. Rosemary, these companies say this is a simple process that shouldn't get in the way of NHS staff, is it?
It certainly isn't a simple process, no. The RCM does support cord blood collection that's collected by designated skilled technicians, but these are ones that are donated and stored in the NHS Cord Blood Bank or the Anthony Nolan facility. And these facilities do ensure that the blood collected is of good quality and safe for future use, but this use is for other people's children's or relatives with other conditions. As we've heard, there is no evidence to support the cause for collecting cord blood for a baby for future use, and that is why the RCM can't support private blood collection.
And does the private collection, in your experience or in the experience of your members, distract NHS staff?
Yes, there is definitely a distraction for the midwives and for the parents. What we are finding is that parents who may have wanted to have a normal birth process with no interference, no drug use, are finding that they need to have a managed third stage to provide enough cord blood in the cord, and this requires them having early clamping of the cord and no pulsating of the cord to allow for the two clamps to be put on it. And we're finding that people have not had the counselling when they've gone through the private companies to assist them in their choice of whether to undertake cord blood sampling or, say, a physiological third stage where they have no intervention. And it's very difficult to get both, to get a very good sample with a with a process of third stage that's not interfered with.
Rebecca, you have a relationship, your company Cells for Life, with an NHS company. Do you accept that your practices can actually be a distraction to the NHS nurses? Hello, Rebecca?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go on.
Hi, I fail to understand how a private cord blood bank who follows exactly the same procurement protocols as a public bank can distract NHS staff if the public bank isn't distracting NHS staff.
We've heard from specialists in the field, Rebecca, who say that as of yet there is no proven value to the storage that your company offers. And you've admitted on this programme that no one has yet been cured as a result of the blood that you have stored. Are you not just preying on vulnerable parents who will spend money, who will do anything to protect their newborn infant?
No, absolutely not. People are looking at this service not because of what is currently standard clinical practice today. They are looking to this service because they have heard of regenerative medicine. They know that stem cells are the basis for regenerative medicine. They know that regenerative medicine is making huge leaps, and they are taking a judged decision for their family whether they think that science is actually going to deliver on those promises, and whether their child will therefore have possibly an advantage or certainly access to future treatments. They're not looking at this because they think their child is going to develop childhood leukemia. They're looking at this and they're seeing research which was being done in Parkinson's disease, in cerebral palsy, in Alzheimer's disease, in multiple sclerosis, in ischemic stroke treatment, in schizophrenia, in erectile dysfunction. And these are not things that happen to children. These are things that happen to adults. And they think, or not, depending on what decision they come to, that if science does make advances in any of these areas and a potential treatment is available, then their child could take advantage of it.
All right, Rebecca Roberts, thank you. Thanks also to Rosemary Exton, who will take your comments on this as well. Would you pay £2,000 to have blood from your child's umbilical cord stored in the hope that later on in life it might save them? Drop us a text to 85058, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk or tweet at BBC5Live on Twitter.
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Investigates with Adrian Goldberg.
On 5 Live Investigates tonight, we've been asking whether parents who spend up to £2,000 on storing blood from their children's umbilical cords in the hope that they might be used to cure an illness in later life are taking a pointless punt, because, as we've been hearing, many experts think it's simply not necessary. We'll be getting your reaction to that shortly, and we'll also be getting to the bottom of claims that thousands of parents whose children are suffering with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, are using the diagnosis to claim a subsidised car off the state. Plus, the environmental health officer who is having his wages paid by the major supermarket chain is meant to police. Now, as we've been hearing, many experts are casting doubt on the practice of storing blood from a child's umbilical cord at a cost of up to £2,000. And Phil Kemp's alongside me, sifting the emails. What we got, Phil?
Yeah, some interesting ones coming in. Someone's text to say that they offered to donate their baby's cord blood to a city hospital in the Midlands, but they said that the hospital didn't even know anything about it. Bob's emailed from Jerusalem to say that he worked with a public cord blood bank in the US. He writes, storing cord blood for future use is highly complex, much more complex than you could imagine, and there are so many, because there are so many events that can cause the sample not to be viable. He goes on to say that public banks have more ability to spot and deal with potential problems.
A cord, this is another email in, a cord blood storage company arranged to collect cord blood from my daughter's baby. But luckily the hospital doctor pointed out that as my daughter has a neurological condition, then it should never have been considered for cord blood collection. Keep them coming. Text us on 85058 or email goldberg@bbc.co.uk. Lucy Costa Duarte is also a customer of one of the companies we've been talking about, Cells for Life. She joins us on Five Live Investigates tonight. She's from Battersea in South London, known as Nappy Valley because of the numbers of new mums and dads who live there. Good evening to you, Lucy.
Good evening.
So you have actually done this. You've stored the umbilical cord blood of three of your children. What were your reasons for doing it?
Well, when we first heard about it, we had a friend who was a doctor who was also considering it, which gave us some sort of confidence. But we took the view that having heard about it, it was kind of hard not to do it, because you'd never forgive yourself if you hadn't done it and something did happen and the science had moved on and it might have been possible to save your child from some hideous illness. And we just took the view that it was something that we just had to do once we knew about it.
Yeah, I mean, you're echoing what San, who we heard from earlier, said, that, you know, he and his wife wouldn't have been able to live with themselves if something had happened to their children. But at the moment, the technology is all based on speculation, isn't it? And you
yeah,
do
absolutely.
Have access.
It is speculation. And in the programme, yeah. you've been saying, you know, it's a punt. And it is a punt. But, you know, this is your child's life, potentially, that you're talking about. And one of your callers earlier said that there was a 1 in 20,000 chance of it being used. And if it's a 1 in 20 million chance, it's you know, in my view, I would still do that for my children. And frankly, if they got some hideous illness and we couldn't use it, well, at least we'd know we'd tried.
But Lucy, there are these public blood banks that you can get access to. We know that stem cell technology works, and the evidence suggests that a public blood bank would be just as, if not more useful, than the private storage route that you've gone down.
Well, I think a lot of the private storage companies actually do share the sample, so some of it is kept privately and some of it is used. For
bank, isn't it, Lucy?
Sorry?
That's certainly the case for Virgin Health Bank, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, and so it's not, when you say private, they're not all entirely private.
Well, Lucy, let me read you an email we've had. Let's see if this reassures you. I'm not suggesting for a moment this relates to Cells for Life, with whom I know you have an account, but this is from someone who says she was a scientist in a private cord blood bank. She says they're just after money, store anything, even samples they know will be useless. Her advice is, quote, unless you have a family history of any disease possibly curable by stem cells, or someone already sick in your family, do not waste your money storing cord blood in private banks. What do you say to that?
Well, I have a close family member with Parkinson's, which is one of the illnesses that they say that they might be able to cure in the future. So I would fall into that category anyway. But I think all of this is, we're talking about science over the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And, you know, if you look back 50 years ago and think where we were then, it's impossible to say where we might be. And every day you open the newspaper and there's something new about stem cells. So, you know, it's a punt that we think is worth taking in our case. And, you know, we were lucky enough that we had the money to do it. And I understand if you don't have the money, you might not want to take the punt. But in our case, we did, and we took the punt.
All right, Lucy, thank you. You can keep your comments coming on the email at goldberg@bbc.co.uk, on the text at 85058, or via Twitter at BBC5Live. And don't forget, if there's something you want us to investigate for you, well, that's what we're here for. Just email goldberg@bbc.co.uk.
Five Live Investigates.
Now, I wonder, did you see that story in the papers today about parents of children with ADHD using the condition to lease a subsidised car off the state as part of the government-backed motability scheme? If that all sounds a bit familiar, well, maybe it's because we ran a similar story here on Five Live Investigates in February, when we heard concerns that parents were deliberately getting their youngsters diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in order to claim benefits. Here's what the teacher of one school told our reporter, Mukul Devachand. The teacher's words were voiced by an actor.
every child that I've got on medication, we are asked to fill part of the forms that they make as benefits claimants to verify that they have ADHD. So it almost goes hand in hand.
So every single child that you have who has ADHD is from a family that's also using that to claim disability living allowance?
Yes. I think parents are very well aware of how the system works in terms of obtaining the drugs for their children and the monetary gains that they get through a diagnosis, and in some cases may well use that to obtain it.
So even when they go and visit a psychiatrist, you think that they know what they're doing?
They know what they're doing. I've got to say yes.
Well, giving way to that story, it's now emerged that around 30,000 people are claiming disability benefits for children with ADHD, compared to a reported 800 a decade ago. Let's speak to Dave Traxon, who's a senior educational psychologist in the West Midlands, who discussed this with us in February. Good evening to you, Dave.
Oh, hi. Nice to talk to you again.
Nice to speak to you again, Dave. It's interesting. We had a load of anecdotal evidence, didn't we, in February?
Absolutely.
And now these figures have emerged to back up the story that we told then. What's your reaction to what's emerged now?
Well, I think my overview is that it's a reflection on a deeply flawed and sick, if you like, system, both at all levels, at a variety of levels, at the level of diagnosing the children with the questionable checklist that we talked about last time, at the level of treating the children with some risky drugs, and now, clearly, at the level of paying related benefits for the conditions that come out of this very questionable process.
Yeah, I mean, it's very concerning, isn't it? Obviously, the taxpayer will be concerned that they perhaps are being ripped off. And you were also concerned, I know, that it's the prescription of Ritalin for children with ADHD that triggers the benefit. So the taxpayer's the loser in this, and so is the child. And we know that in many cases, Ritalin is appropriate and it can work. But for other children, it appears that it may be being used simply by the parents as a means to get benefits, and in this case, cars.
Well, no, absolutely. I mean, we know that about £30 million is spent on psychostimulants last year, and that is a lot of money. But what is more apparent is the levels of money that are then spent on disabled living allowance. And I'd like to say that some parents absolutely deserve it, you know, because of their levels of deprivation and because of the severity of the child's condition. But psychologists all around the country have concerns about the number of appropriate diagnoses. And in the other cases, you know, it could be part of this culture of sort of what we call a culture of incentivization, that, you know, the bankers are getting bonuses, the shareholders are getting dividends, and these parents are thinking, well, you know, if I can rip off the system, I'll do that too.
This is a real dilemma for the government, isn't it, Dave? Because, as you say, there will be some parents of children who genuinely have ADHD.
Absolutely.
Who do need to be prescribed Ritalin, who may, because of their children's behavioural problems, may not be able to work, they may not have the transport available to them. So for them, getting hold of a car may be a lifeline. But as you say, others may be incentivised and using their child's ADHD diagnosis as a means, as a route to getting benefits. A real tough one. How does a doctor, how does the government decide which ones are the ones abusing the system and which ones are legitimately entitled?
Well, I think all of us have to take responsibility for following our own professional guidelines. And it's the thoroughness, really, of the investigation that's important. I mean, I remember talking last time about the triangulation of data, that we need to get information from the parents, obviously, but we also need to make sure that that information is backed up from the schools and also any youth organisations or football teams that the young people belong to.
Because and that wasn't always happening, was it?
No, it happens in about half the cases.
Yeah. Dave, great to speak to you. Thanks indeed for updating that with us. Dave Traxon, Senior Educational Psychologist from the West Midlands. If you've got any comments on that, feel free to get in touch. You can email goldberg@bbc.co.uk. You can text 85058 or tweet at BBC5Live on Twitter. Now, last week, we investigated the relationship between trading standards officers and the businesses they're meant to keep an eye on. We revealed that some trading standards authorities are taking money from firms in their patch. In the case of West Yorkshire Trading Standards, they're getting money from a payday loans broker with a string of complaints against it. And it turns out that trading standards officers aren't the only ones in the town hall who are getting money from the traders they're meant to inspect. We were contacted after last week's programme by a council worker who said we should look at what environmental health departments are up to as well. So we did. Our reporter Ben Carter has been looking at this. Ben, what have you found?
Well, Adrian, what do you think about this? The entire salary of an environmental health officer working at Charwell District Council in Oxfordshire is being paid for by Sainsbury's. And that environmental health officer's role is to, well, advise and inspect Sainsbury's.
So advise and inspect. Now, obviously, advising the company is one thing. Inspecting them is something else altogether, especially when that officer is having his or her salary paid for by that company. So how does that role work?
Well, the existence of this role affects Sainsbury's customers right across the UK, and that's because any complaints about Sainsbury's will get sent to Charwell District Council and dealt with by the environmental health officer there. And that's because Charwell is in charge of complaints about Sainsbury's anywhere in the country.
Yeah, we came across this last week, didn't we, in relation to West Yorkshire. But if people weren't listening then, and we forgive them, why does this one local authority have responsibility for all the Sainsbury's across the country?
Well, it's because of the change in the law. In the past, local trading standards and environmental health officers would visit businesses on their patch and offer advice and support. But these days, if a business has branches all over the country, they can choose one authority, normally where the head office is based, to set up a partnership. That becomes what's known as the primary authority, and it then receives queries, complaints and inspection requests from all other councils looking into that business.
So that's not necessarily a problem, is it? But if one local authority controls all of the inspection requests for a nationwide chain, obviously then it's very important that we can trust that local authority.
Well, it is, and an environmental health officer who contacted us told me he had concerns about this type of funding arrangement. He wanted to remain anonymous, but he told me that there's the element of he who pays the piper calls the tune. Mm. And he said that he could imagine a junior inspector feeling under pressure to do what the business paying his or her salary wants.
So, really, we've got a whistleblower contacting 5 Live Investigates.
Absolutely. And another interesting thing he told me was that big companies don't have to use the local authority where their head office is based. They can shop around. And our whistleblower said he'd had dealings with one company which he said was clearly shopping around for a local authority which was going to be a soft touch.
Fascinating. Now, this has been quite a major change in the law, hasn't it? It restricts the power of individual local trading standards officers to take action against the local branch of a national chain. So why did things change like this?
Well, it goes back to 2004 when the last government ordered a review, and the person who did the review just happened to be the chairman of Sainsbury's at the time, Sir Philip Hampton. And basically, the recommendations in his review led to the changes in the law, which allow Sainsbury's to pay the salary of the person in charge of inspecting their stores on behalf of the public.
It's curious, this, isn't it? I mean, how does Sainsbury's explain the fact that they're paying the salary of the officer charged with inspecting them?
In a statement, Sainsbury's told me primary authority officers at all times retain their professional duty to the local authority that employs them. The agreement between Sainsbury's and Charwell District Council in no way compromises the integrity of any of the parties involved.
OK, and what do the council say?
Charwell District Council say that the primary authority officers are employed by local authorities, acting as a primary contact for an organisation. As such, they are wholly impartial and independent, and they do not act for or represent the relevant business in any way.
Mm. The question, though, Ben, is how it looks, isn't it? It's this question of the potential for conflict of interest. I know that nearly every organisation and business that you've spoken to in the last couple of weeks has said that all they're doing is following the rules created by the previous Labour government, currently being expanded by the new Conservative Lib Dem coalition government.
Well, that's what they do say, and we've asked the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills to answer the critics who say there is a potential conflict of interest that may put the consumer at risk, but no ministers are available to speak to us.
Indeed not. They have sent us a statement saying primary authority has been shown to be extremely effective and does not prevent companies from being regulated successfully. It is only right that we carefully consider how to spend the taxpayers' money and let business take some of the burden here. Only if it is shown to be ineffective should we consider another option. Let's speak to Graham Jukes, who's Chief Executive of the Chartered Institute of Environmental Health. Good evening to you, Graham.
Good evening, Adrian.
I mean, the key point, and it's the one we hammered home last week, is this potential conflict of interest, whether it's trading standards, whether it's environmental health. How can companies pay for the jobs of the people who regulate them and who inspect them?
Yeah, I was interested in the comments from your anonymous environmental health officer earlier on in the piece, because frankly, I think what he's talking is nonsense. I wouldn't mind his name, actually, so I could talk to him about it. The issue here is about efficiency and effectiveness. And the primary authority scheme, which we didn't like when it was first introduced in 2008. In fact, I've gone on record to say that it was overly bureaucratic at that time as it was passing through Parliament. But we have changed our minds since then. There are significant benefits to the economy of this country by having smoother, more effective regulatory compliance methods in place, and primary authority is one of those.
So do you think...
Hold on a minute. I take great exception to the suggestion that not only is this new way of working somehow damaging public confidence, but I take great exception to the fact that my officers and environmental health officers and indeed trading standards officers are in any way, shape or form ruining or doing anything which is counter to public confidence and good public health.
Well, what are the benefits to the public then of having companies like Sainsbury's paying the salaries of the people who are designated to advise and inspect them?
Right, the issue here is that where there is a multi-site business, and Sainsbury's, Asda, Tesco, all of the big retail companies have very effective internal systems, and in fact many of my members are actually employed by these organisations as well as in local government. So professionally, we cover a vast range of employment activities. Those companies have, I would say, state-of-the-art systems of management and control to protect the public health. The issue here is that many, many local authorities, where they have individual stores and outlets, are having to inspect those, and often they will ask for different things to be carried out. And it makes sense, therefore, not only for the enforcers to have some form of coordination here, but also the companies themselves to be able to rely upon one decision as opposed to 433 decisions relating to the numbers and the types of activities that go on in their stores.
Yeah, people might understand that, Graham, but they might also question whether that one person making that decision should then be funded by the organisation whose job it is to regulate.
Well, I would put it the other way and say that why should a single local authority pay for the enforcement requirements of the rest of the country? That every other single local authority has a responsibility to address these individual stores, and they're continuing to do so. Why should one authority and the residents and ratepayers within that particular area fund that national activity? Surely it's right that the company itself should contribute, and this is what we're talking about, contribute to
the burden that that individual local authority is taking on in acting in this role.
All right, Graham, thanks very much indeed for being with us this evening. We'll continue to pursue this here on 5 Live Investigates.
Across the UK,
this is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Investigates with Adrian Goldberg.
Thanks for downloading the 5 Live Investigates podcast. And don't forget, if there's something you want us to investigate, you can email goldberg@bbc.co.uk.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.